dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The main body of today's program features a talk given by historian Howard Zinn on April 12th at Cornell University. The talk was billed as addressing the subject, Is Democracy Possible? That title really didn't reflect the talk that Zinn actually gave, however, in which he addressed the historical events in his own life that shaped his work as an historian, teacher, and activist. In the talk, Zinn makes clear that organized resistance is the key to building democracy. He also makes clear the undemocratic and anti-democratic intent of the framers of the Constitution and how it reflected the class struggles of 18th century America. Following the Zinn talk, some news and announcements about a boycott of Clear Channel Communications in the fight for media democracy. Before we get into the Zinn talk, here's an important announcement about an action that's taking place locally regarding the infamous School of Assassins, the School of the Americas, which is a U.S. military installation at Fort Benning, Georgia, which has trained thousands of Latin American military personnel on how to torture and repress their own people. Graduates of this school are responsible for the deaths and torture of thousands of people, from Jesuit priests to trade unionists. School of the Americas Watch is an organization led by Father Roy Bourgeois, which has been trying to cut the funding for the training facility for years. Thousands have demonstrated and hundreds have been arrested and imprisoned for protests at the school. Our tax dollars are funding this school to train these torturers. Legislative measures to cut the funding to the School of the Americas have lost by only a few votes each time. Now, Ithaca Catholic Workers and Kuslar are inviting you to join a 3-day march from Ithaca to Corning, New York, to meet with Representative Armory Houghton on Monday, April 30th, and urge him to join all efforts to close the School of the Americas. Representative Houghton has not supported efforts to close the SOA in the past. Father Roy Bourgeois will be present to kick off the walk by speaking from his personal experience about why the School of the Americas is not reformed, even though it has had a name change, and why it must be closed. Roy Bourgeois will be speaking Thursday, April 26th at noon at Catholic Charities. Catholic Charities is located at 305 West Buffalo Street, and he will be speaking again that day at 8 p.m. at Ithaca College in room number 102 in Textor Hall. For more information on any of these School of America actions and lectures, you can contact Lisa or Audrey at 607 area code 277-8962. This program, Unwelcome Guests, is pre-taped. At the moment, the Summit of the Americas and protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas are taking place in Quebec City, as well as many other cities throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Some of the producers of this program have gone to cover the events surrounding the FTAA, and we hope to have material for you in the coming weeks. Now, here's Howard Zinn speaking at Cornell last week.
Mark Selden is going to introduce Howard Zinn. He's a professor of sociology and history at Binghamton University and East Asian program at Cornell University.
I was a little bit worried as I headed over here, and I thought, you know, maybe this is going to be an audience of 60s and 70s people who remembered Howard. From the old days, but Fortunately, that's not the case. And as I drove in, of course, I saw the big demonstration in front of Day Hall, and I thought, yes. I thought Howard's in town for sure. Howard's Inn is the people's historian. I think he's the finest historian that this country has produced, precisely because for half a century, he's been at the forefront of our most important popular movements, from the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement in Vietnam, the Gulf War, and elsewhere. And with a personal biography that goes back to his time in the Air Force at the end of World War II, important moment in his life also. Above all, it seems to me, it's Howard's experience coming out of his extraordinary poet's ear and his empathy for the oppressed, especially for those who resist, that is the reason that so many people have come out to hear him today. And I think it's appropriate that he come back to Cornell on the topic that he's talking about today. After all, Cornell has produced some of the landmark events in the civil rights movement in the 60s and some of the major contributions to the anti-war movement associated with the Berrigans, associated with the late George Cahan, and student activists who were in the forefront of the anti-war movement. I first met Howard in June 1966 at a rather difficult moment for him. He'd been teaching in the South at Spelman College in Atlanta and associated in many ways as an activist, later as a writer, with the rising movement known as SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he'd been invited to Japan to speak there both about the war in Vietnam and about the civil rights movement. And he and a young black civil rights activist, Ralph Featherstone, arrived in Japan in June at the very moment that SNCC and much of the civil rights movement made a cataclysmic shift to black power, leaving people like Howard, who had been active working with them in a most difficult position. He went on a speaking tour around Japan, having to explain what this change was in the civil rights movement under the most difficult possible circumstances while having to sort this out himself. Unfortunately, there was a very sad ending to this story. Ralph Featherstone returned to Baltimore right after their 2 weeks in Japan. And was killed by a car bombing shortly after that. So those were times that were difficult and also times that were making important statements in the American civil rights movement. I next met Howard in 1969 when he gave a keynote talk at the Association for Asian Studies at a time when student activists were putting pressure on the Asian Studies establishment to take a position on the war. And Howard talked in a hall of this kind at which he put to the Asian studies profession the need for turning away from some of the ancient studies that dominated the profession and examining the crisis that America in Asia was facing at that time. And of course, he put forward his own trademark analysis of the logic for withdrawal from Vietnam. To a degree that I think has no equal in American intellectual and political life, Howard has brought together his politics, his scholarship, and his life. From the 60s, when he was teaching in Atlanta, working with SNCC and other civil rights movements at the time, a group that he eventually wrote about in one of his two most important books, SNCC, The New Abolitionists, thereby contributing both in the front lines of the movement and by bringing it to the attention of Americans. And what he said at the start of that book, I think, runs through everything that he's written before and since and conveys much of Howard's greatness. What he saw there is this. For the first time in our history, he wrote, a major social movement shaking the nation to its bones is being led by youngsters. And it's that feeling that Howard's had, I think, that has made his work so attractive to so many people, and especially to youngsters over the years. It's always been Howard's great gift to speak to youth, and I think you're in for a great treat tonight. It's difficult to think of a better speaker to address the question, is democracy possible? Howard Zinn.
I must be in Ithaca. Actually, that's a feeling I've had all day. You know, yeah, it's Ithaca. Ooh, what a place. And you seem to know it, because everybody I met here, I ask them, you know, hey, how do you like it here? They all love it here. And you know. And so they're willing to let me have it for 24 hours. well, thank you for inviting me. And thank you, Mark Selden, for that really nice introduction. Almost truthful. And I remember very well meeting Mark in Japan, and He became one of those young scholars who in the 60s became a dissenter in the scholarly academy. Now, one of the interesting things that happened in the 60s is we began to get little rebels inside of every discipline, little rebels who were undisciplined, you know. And we began to get radical Asian scholars and radical political scientists and radical historians and economists and so on, sociologists, and yeah, let's see, were there radical chemists? I'm trying to remember, but I don't want to leave anybody out. But and Mark was a pioneer in that, and continues to be in his writing and teaching. And so whenever you meet somebody from that time, you know, there's something very special. You know, like, people have been in prison together. People have gone through anything together. Well, what will I talk about? You notice? People want to know. But I thought about, well, I said I would talk about democracy. Everybody wants to talk about democracy. I'd be suspicious of people who use that word too much, right? So often we've been fooled, right? But of course, I'm not going to fool you about democracy. Now, I want to talk about it, but I'm going to lead into it by talking. Let me put it this way. My views on democracy came to me, my special views on democracy, came to me, I suppose, because, well, of my study of history, but maybe mostly because my own history, my own background, you know, my own growing up, which sort of made me look at the world in a slightly different and maybe peculiar way. But I, because from the moment I began to sort of think of studying history, teaching history, writing history, I knew that I wasn't going to be a neutral historian, you know. I would tell my students right on the first day of class, this is not going to be a neutral class. This is not going to be one of those classes where you spend a semester with a teacher or a year with a teacher, and at the end of that time, you have no idea where that teacher stands on the important issues of the day. You know, there are such. And I didn't want to be that way. I wanted my students to know where I stood. I wanted to know where they stood, And I thought then it would be interesting. And I wasn't worried about indoctrinating my students, you know, because people said, oh, you're going to give your point of view in class? Indoctrinating these poor, innocent students? I knew my students weren't innocent. My students were 18, 19, 20, 21, sometimes 62, right? And, you know, they had come to my class after 18 or 20 years of education, or whatever it was called, of listening to television, of reading the major media. They had come to my class already with huge gobs of bad ideas and huge gaps, you know, of important information. And so that, no, how could I, you know, they aren't blank slates. I'm not going to indoctrinate them. All that I could do is, well, the way I saw it is there's a marketplace of ideas. It's not a free marketplace of ideas. There's no free marketplace of ideas any more than there's a free marketplace of goods, right? People talk about the free market. No such thing as a free market. Every market is dominated by those people who have the power and the wealth to dominate it. That's true of goods, and that's true of ideas. And so the market of ideas is not free. It's dominated by the people who control the educational system, by the people who control the media, the people who publish the textbooks, and so on. And so all that I figured that I was doing was sort of, you might say, wheeling my little push cart into the marketplace, you know. that's all. I saw myself as a push cart peddler, you know, push cart PhD. Pushcart peddler, you know, and really saying, okay, take a look at this, you know, check it out, see if it makes sense. I wasn't worried about indoctrinating. I wasn't going to be neutral. I knew history was not objective. I never believed in objectivity. How can history be objective, right? History is always a selection. You write history, you present history, history is always, when it's presented, is a selection out of an enormous mass of data. And no matter how fat the textbook, right? And some, when you're a kid, you know, they give you these fat textbooks. You think, wow, I guess it's all there. You know, what else could there be? You know, it's like you're reading the New York Times, which is fat also. Especially on Sunday, I guess it is all the news that's fit to print. Yeah, absolutely. The worst kind of deception is not lying to you. The worst kind of a deception is leaving things out. Because if they lie to you, you can check up on it. But if they leave things out, you know, how do you know? How do you know about it? I knew that history was always a process of selection, you know, whatever pretenses historians gave to being objective and so on. And I knew that the selection that historians made, just like the selection journalists made, the selection editors make, you know, is based on a point of view. It's based on an idea of, oh, this is important. This is important to tell, you see. And this is not important to tell. But they don't tell you about the things that are not important to tell you. You have to find that out for yourself. It soon became clear to me that history was being written from a certain point of view, and that the same point of view kept being repeated over and over again. And on all levels, from elementary school up through graduate school, I very often found that in graduate school, I found the same point of view about a historical problem that I got in junior high school, only with footnotes, you know. I already had a point of view about history. And I guess I had a point of view about history because... Well, yeah, because of my life, you know. Because at the age of 18, I didn't go to college. At the age of 18, I went to work in a shipyard, worked in a shipyard for 3 years. I didn't do it as a sociological experiment, you know. let's see what the shipyard workers are like. Give them a questionnaire to fill out, you know. I just came from the kind of, you know, working class family, and came from a neighborhood where kids, when they reached the age of 18, they didn't go to college, they went to work. And so I went to work in the shipyard, and I became one of the, I found three other guys like me. Well, not quite, but almost. That is, we all had a similar idea. We were young radicals. I say that in a hushed tone. Because, you know, you never know who's listening. And the four of us became a little organizing group in the shipyard. And we organized the young shipyard workers because we were excluded from the craft unions of the AFL, you know, which excluded black people and women and unskilled workers, and we were very unskilled, you see, except in organizing, you see. And so we were, you know, so, yeah. That's a period in which you might say I grew up class conscious, right? That's a phrase not often heard in the United States. It's a phrase people are sometimes afraid of, you know, class, you know. You hear politicians accusing one another of appealing, right? To class hatred, right? A presidential candidate accuses another presidential candidate is appealing to class hatred. Why? He asked for 5 cents more on the minimum wage, you know. Really, it's that sort of thing. I remember Bush. I don't mean this Bush. Not the shrub. the Bush. Remember him running against Duke. He was ran against Dukakis. Do you remember Dukakis? Some of you may remember. Yeah, he was, you know, I lived in Massachusetts. He was the governor of Massachusetts, very nice person. Bush accused him of appealing to class hatred. It made anybody in Massachusetts laugh, you know. But, you know, in the United States, we grow up with, and we're supposed to believe that this is one great society. You know, we're all one. It's one family. There are other countries where they're rich and poor and people always fighting one another and so on. Not here in the United States. This is America. You know, the Constitution begins, the preamble, we the people of the United States. You know, and we have all this language which binds us together. You know, national security. You know, right? And this is, how do you decide whether you're going to send troops somewhere? Well, you decide. Is it for national security? Well, nobody asks. Is it for anybody's securities? You know, what is it? What is the idea? You know, national security, national interest. Is this? And you hear supposedly intelligent people getting up there on television, and they're asked this question: do you think we should intervene? And so on. So, well, if it is in the national interest, well, there's no national interest. There's his interest in mine. I mean, it's not Exxon and me. There are interests and there are interests. You know, there's not one America. You know, there are many Americas with different interests. When I started to write and teach history, I was class conscious, and I knew that the history books that I had been given in school and right up through graduate school did not reflect the reality that I saw of a society divided, you know, between rich, very rich at the top, and poor people below, and a lot of nervous people in between, you see. And they say, oh, we have a wonderful big middle class of people with this and people with that. No, these people are insecure. Because we live in the kind of society, we live in the kind of system where insecurity is there, even for people at the middle level, because they never know what the next day will bring to them. because they're not in control of their own fate, even though they may be professionals and so on. There are people who are in control and who decide, what happens. I saw that the textbooks that, in school, and they acted as if they didn't understand, that this was a class, society. And that we were, from the beginning. In the American Revolution, all the colonists are together fighting patriotically against England. Mel Gibson, doing it alone, you see. And, but it wasn't that way. It wasn't that way. Because before the American Revolution, that long period that preceded the conflict with Britain, for that 150 years of colonial history, between 1607 and 1763, that long period of colonial history was not a period marked by a united colonial society against England. It was a period marked by conflict, internal conflict, class conflict, and slaves versus slave owners, slave rebellions, tenant rebellions against landlords, small farmers against the gentry, and indentured servants rebelling against their masters, riots of the poor against the rich, flour riots and bread riots, and people breaking into warehouses to get bread and flour and attacking the homes of speculators. And this is a long period of class conflict before the American Revolution. Then the American Revolution comes along, and now we're together. The Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal. And, well, we won't talk about a few limitations there. But it didn't, and yes, it worked sort of to bring people together, yes, but not everybody. And the class conflict continued during the American Revolution. Because class differences continued during the Revolution. Because the officers were getting splendid clothes and food and high pay, and the privates were treated like dirt, and the privates weren't getting paid, and they were not given shoes and given lousy food. And so they rebelled. There were mutinies in George Washington's army. I don't know what you learned when you studied the American Revolution in school, but I never learned anything about the mutinies in Washington's army. Mutinies of thousands of soldiers who were disgruntled and angry at their treatment. So many thousands of them in the Pennsylvania line that Washington was worried about how to deal with this. He couldn't put it down by force because he knew that this might spread. He knew that the grievances were all over his army, and so he dealt with them so carefully and made concessions and mustered half of them out, which is what they wanted. They weren't aching to fight against the British. They were aching to get out of the army. But then shortly after, when there was a mutiny in the New Jersey line, and this is not thousands now, it's hundreds, Washington said, oh, we can deal with this. And the orders went, kill them. And they took out, just picked out two of the mutineers and had them executed, shot by their fellow mutineers. When the revolution was over, and that binding Declaration of Independence, that idealistic view of what they were fighting for, began to dissipate. And people went back, and the same situation that happens all the time after every war. The veterans have made big promises. Oh, thank you. Wow. This is great. Thanks. This has never happened to me. Really, I'm serious. I have had all sorts of people deliver water to me. Really. Yeah, I mean, I could describe the many different kinds of people who have delivered water to me, but never had two great little kids deliver water to me. Wow. So I have to drink it. Well, what I started to say was that after the war, the veterans of the war were treated like veterans of wars always are. You know, they've been given great promises in the war about what you're fighting for, the great noble ideals. And then they come back, the veterans come back after the war, and they come back to the same miserable lives that they left before. Well, maybe now they're given a little piece of land. Maybe they're given a GI Bill. Maybe they're given some things after the war. But basically, the class system remains. And so in 1786, you know, 3 years after the official ending of the war, in 1786 in western Massachusetts, there's a rebellion of farmers. A lot of you know about that, Shays' Rebellion. Or some of you just may recognize it from a multiple choice test, you know. Shays' Rebellion, yeah. So, farmers in western Massachusetts, many of them veterans of the Revolution, and now they have their little piece of land, but they're being taxed, and they can't pay. And so their farms are being taken away from them, the livestock, their homes being taken away, auctioned off in the courthouses. And so they organize by the thousands. Captain Daniel Shays, one of the leaders. And they organize by the thousands, and they march on the courthouses, and they surround the courthouses, and they don't let the auctions take place. And they do this again and again and again in town after town after town in western Massachusetts, in Amherst, in Northampton, in Springfield, in Great Barrington. They do this again and again. Finally, an army is sent to suppress them. But, and this is something I have not seen in any of the teaching on the revolution and the Constitution. I've never seen the textbooks or classes that have been to make a connection between Shays' Rebellion and the Constitution. Because what happened is, you know, Shays' Rebellion, 1786, the Constitution is framed in 1787. The founding fathers, who were going to gather in Philadelphia, were worried about Shays' Rebellion. They were really upset about it. The letters flew back and forth. What shall we do? This is serious. Because it's not only Massachusetts, it was happening in Rhode Island and Pennsylvania. They were really worried, these people. One of Washington's generals, Henry Knox, wrote a letter to George Washington about this. Knox was a member of the Order of the Cincinnati, which had been formed after the Revolutionary War. Veterans, not all veterans, not lowly veterans, high veterans, you know, substantial people, as we say. And Knox wrote to Washington, and he said, I can't reproduce his elegant language. You know, his people were very elegant. You know, the language that they used. You know, you have to hand it to them. You know, whatever you take away from them, and I will. But you have to hand them their use of language. You compare them to our political leaders of today. You know, really, it's... So Knox writes to Washington, as I say, I can't reproduce, but he says something like this. Look... hey, what's going on here? You know, Knox says essentially this. He says, look, these people, you know, think, you know, that because they fought in the Revolution, you see, that they deserve an equal share of the wealth of this country. Well, something has to be done. The founding fathers who got in Philadelphia were very conscious of Shays' Rebellion. They got together and fashioned a constitution that would make sure that a government would be strong enough to deal with future rebellions. And the constitution wasn't framed simply by these wise men got together and they said, how can we establish democracy? No, that was not it. That was not it. No. They wanted to set up a government that would protect slaveholders against slave rebellions, that would protect manufacturers by giving them tariffs, that would protect people who moved out west into Indian land to be able to furnish an army to fight off the Indians and clear the way for the settlers. A government strong enough by taxing people to pay off the bondholders, you know. It's important to know this about the Constitution. When Charles Beard, I don't know how you know the name, but he was a great historian of the 20th century. Charles Beard in 1913 wrote a book called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, and it was a shocker. He dared to question the integrity of the founding fathers. He dared to say, you know, these guys, they were guys, by the way, they were 55, mostly rich white guys, not a multicultural group, you know. And he dared, to say, hey, let's look at the economic interests and political ideology of these 55 men. And let's see if there's a connection between that and the kind of constitution they put together. Well, New York Times had an editorial denouncing Beard. New York Times doesn't customarily have editorials paying any attention to historians. I mean, many of us would love to be denounced by the New York Times, you see. But no. But yes, they denounced Beard. Because the Constitution, and still remains a hallowed document, and the Founding Fathers, you know, to question the Founding Fathers is patricide, close to it, really. And some of you may remember the year of the bicentennial, 1987. Well, I'm looking around. Some of you remember it. Some of it you were in 1987, 14 years ago. Some of you were 5 years old. You should know. 5 years old, you should have been reading the papers. Yes. But 1987, the bicentennial year of the Constitution, 200 years after the framing of the Constitution. You know, there's a bicentennial every year for something or other, you know, because something happens every, you know, something always happened 200 years ago, so it's convenient. But the bicentennial constitution was accompanied by huzzas and panegyrics around this noble document, the constitution, you know, how Ronald Reagan was president at the time. I don't know if you remember, but you know, some of you may just know the airport. But Ronald Reagan wrote an essay about the Constitution, believe it or not. And it appeared, you know, appeared in some scholarly journal, I think Parade magazine, you know. And in it, Reagan said, and this is, I'm not distorting what he said. How could I distort what, I mean, how could I possibly make worse what Reagan said? No. Reagan, he said, this Constitution is such a perfect document. It could only have been fashioned with the guiding hand of God. No, that's awesome. That really, literally awesome. Yeah. That year, the bicentennial, there was only one dissenting voice in the higher circles of American government about this general adulation about the Constitution. The one dissenting voice came from the one black member of the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall made a speech in the bicentennial year, and he said, in effect, what are you getting excited about? Really? The Constitution legitimized slavery, you know. No, the Constitution and the Founding Fathers did not deserve to be seen as perfect and pure and God-given and so on. It needs to be looked at critically. Important to keep that in mind when you thinking about, you know, what democracy is. I was talking about my attitude towards class difference in this country. That the Constitution as a class document is seen very clearly when you read James Madison's argument for ratification of the Constitution. You know, there was a debate over ratification. It didn't get easily ratified. In the three most important states, Massachusetts, Virginia, New York, it was a very close call for ratifying the Constitution. In New York State, a very close call. And Madison, Hamilton, and Jay wrote essays in the New York papers to persuade people to vote for ratification. And Madison wrote Federalist Paper Number 10. And in it, he said, again, you'll have to take my word for it. But really, he said this. He said, look, I claim all of these guys started off that way. You see? Society is divided into factions. He might have said classes, right? But Marx wasn't born yet. And factions. Factions based on who has property, who doesn't have property. And there's always going to be conflict between these factions. And we need to set up a government that will be able to do something about this conflict, will be able to control this conflict between the people without property and the people with property. And the faction we need to worry most about is not a minority faction, but a majority faction. That's a sobering thought. You have to worry about a majority faction. And what was he worried about with a majority faction? He said what he was worried about. He said, these people will call for an abolition of debt, for an equal division of property, or for any other improper or wicked object. No. So they knew what they were doing. I mean, these days, of course, there's disguise, But they were honest about what they were doing, you see. But when I read the history books, class and class conflict and, the story of the economic miracle in the United States, the period between the Civil War and end of the Civil War and World War I, the period of enormous economic expansion in the United States, the period of the great economic miracle. And those things are always presented as if they apply equally to everybody, right? It's a great economic miracle, so it must have been an economic miracle for everybody, But you learn about you. And I remember sitting there in class and reveling in how many more miles of railroad track were laid during that period than before, and the romantic story of the Transcontinental Railroad, the Union Pacific from one side, the Central Pacific from the other side. They meet, you see. It was a glorious moment. But I wasn't told about the Chinese laborers and the Irish laborers who worked on that railroad. Really, nothing about them. They were absent. They were invisible. What Ralph Ellison said about black people is also true to a large extent about the people who work, you see. They're invisible. And they died by the thousands in the heat and the cold and sickness and so on. I wasn't told about that. I wasn't told about the girls who went to work in textile mills of Lowell, Lawrence, Massachusetts, at the age of 12 and died at the age of 25. This was in the 1830s, 1840s. This was in the period called the Age of Jackson. And I remember learning about the Age of Jackson. It was the age of the rise of democracy. In fact, that's the phrase. The phrase was Jacksonian democracy. Jacksonian democracy was a time when the ugliness of the industrial system was beginning in various parts of the country. It was also the time when Jackson was ordering his army down into the southeastern part of the United States to drive the five civilized tribes, the Cherokees and the Creeks and the Choctaws and the others, to drive them westward across the Mississippi, thousands of them dying along the route, So much in the historical education of this country is so warped by this insistence that, you know, what goes for the people on top, you know, goes for everybody. Now, I guess I first became aware of this maybe when I was doing my doctoral dissertation on Fiorello LaGuardia. A lot of you know Fiorello LaGuardia, right? I think. Maybe some of you only know him as an airport, too. But Fiorello LaGuardia was a mayor, of colorful mayor of New York, but I was working on, in fact, his congressional period, which a lot of people don't know about. Before he was mayor of New York, he was a congressman from New York in the 1920s. 1920s? I knew what the 1920s was because I'd studied history. 1920s was the jazz age. 1920s was the age of prosperity. It was that in junior high school, and it was that on the graduate level. In fact, not long ago, I was watching television. I know this. I shouldn't say this. I know it's an intellectual doesn't watch television, you see. But I accidentally turned on the television, you see. But even when I accidentally turned on television, I turned it on to public television, see. And there was the American Experience, and it was about the Great Crash, you know, right? 1929, it was about the 1920s. And this is what the narrator said. Really, he really did say this. Everybody was doing well in the 20s. Everybody was interested in the stock market. The bootblack owned shares of stock, and so on. So, and this is just recently, right? I would have thought maybe they've learned since then, you know. But here I was doing work on LaGuardia in the 1920s in the jazz age, and I was reading the letters that his constituents in East Harlem were writing to him. And what were they writing about? They were saying, "My husband is out of work. We don't have enough food. They've turned off the gas. This is in the age of prosperity." And then when I looked further, I saw this was true all over the country, that there were people living in the miserable circumstances all over the country in this age of prosperity. From that time on, I became very leery of these labels that they give us, the way they blanket whole periods, you know. The progressive period of American history, you know, there's a progressive era, early part of the 20th century. It's exactly that period in which more black people were lynched than in any other time in American history, you know. But I became weary of you know, the economic miracle. How many times in the last several years have we heard the presidents and presidential candidates get up and say, America is booming, you know, we're doing very well, you know. And the Dow Jones average is, well, that's what they used to say, the Dow Jones average, you know. But the idea is we're supposed to measure our prosperity by the Dow Jones average. Every night on television, you know, no matter what is happening in the world, you can be sure of one thing, the Dow Jones average. You will know about it. They don't give you the, you know, latest figures on child mortality, on unemployment, on lack of health insurance, and that's the Dow Jones average to measure the prosperity of our country. So we're all wrapped in this great, you know, this is America, right? And it's what Kurt Vonnegut called a grand falloon. It's a great big bubble which conceals all the complexities inside, and you have to occasionally burst that bubble in order to understand, you know, the complicated reality of life. So, after my time in the shipyard, I'm going to take you through my life year by year. Maybe I might skip a few, just, you know, to be kind. But but all this is to tell you how I came to my view of history and my view of democracy and this and that. This is my excuse for telling you all of this. But after the ship, I enlisted in the Air Force, became a bombardier in the Air Force. You know, I guess I have to tell you it was World War II. If I don't tell you, you might think it was the Spanish-American War. No. But it was World War II. I enlisted. I was an enthusiastic bombardier. It was because the issues were clear. It was fascism and us. Evil on the one side, good on our side, you know. And so I dropped bombs on various towns in Europe. But by the end of the war, I was beginning to undergo a kind of slow change in my thinking, which was accentuated, I think, probably after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, although I had welcomed the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki when it happened. I was on a 30-day leave from Europe on the way to Japan, my wife and I were going to take a trip into the country during my 30-day leave before I could go off to Japan, and we stopped at a newsstand, and there was a huge headline, "Atom Bomb Dropped on Hiroshima." And I remember very well my reaction, "Wow, this is great." You know, yeah. What did I know? It's a bomb, another bomb, maybe a different kind of bomb, but I had no idea of what it meant in human terms, just as I had no idea what it meant in human terms about the bombs that I dropped on human beings, people I didn't see. You know, because when you drop bombs from 30,000 feet, you don't hear any screams, you don't see any blood, and you can do anything. To this day, I understand how atrocities are committed, you know, but these are not human beings, you know. Technology and training and obedience take over and so on. But then I read, shortly after that, I read John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. Some of you know that book. And he was a war correspondent who went into, right after the bombing, he went into Hiroshima and he talked to the survivors. He talked to the people who were still alive. People who are blind and people without limbs and people who are suffering from radiation disease, you know. And he talked to these people and he wrote down. And suddenly the bombing came to me in human terms, you know, what have we done? And I thought more about the war and I thought more about, and this was the best war, as we know. This was the good war. And the more I thought about it, and I looked at the world around me, now that we had fought this good war and we had won, and now the world would be different, and fascism was defeated. And then I looked around the world, and fascism was not defeated. No. Yeah, Hitler was defeated, Mussolini was defeated, and the Japanese Empire was defeated, but fascism was still there in many parts of the world, even in some parts of our country, really, if you think about prisons. Think about the military. If you think about, but fascism certainly, you know, militarism was not gone, racism was not gone. All those things represented by fascism still in the world. 50 million people were dead, you know. And I began to think, no, war doesn't solve anything fundamentally, you know. And we're going to have to find different ways. We're just going to have to use our human ingenuity, which can do fantastic things with technology. Find different ways to deal with trouble in the world, other than killing huge numbers of people. So that affected the way I wrote then when I was writing People's History. That way I affected the way I was writing about war and the various wars that the United States engaged in. And that, you know, that affected me when the United States was moving into Vietnam, and I knew both the history of American foreign policy and I knew my own experience with war. And then, after the Air Force, I went to college under the GI Bill, became a freshman at the age of 27. This is to encourage those of you who are taking, you know, 10, 15 years. My first teaching job was at Spelman College, Atlanta, Georgia. Became involved as Mark Selden Toad became involved in the movement and so on. And it was the greatest learning experience for me. And I learned so much about history. You know, you look at history from a black point of view, it looks different. You look at history from a Native American point of view, from a women's point of view, everything looks different. So I began to read the black historians who were not on my reading lists in graduate school. But mostly becoming involved in the movement, I learned about democracy. I began to think about, well, you know, democracy, and I realized that the education we all get about democracy must be something close to the education I got in junior high school, and which is repeated on all levels. And as democracy consists of a set of structures that we can be proud of, which, you know, the teacher was putting it on the board when I was in junior high school, the diagrams, three branches of government, legislative, you know all that stuff, executive, judicial, and the lines were drawn between three checks and balances. I remember sitting there, wow, this is neat. This is really good. If one branch does something bad, it will be checked by another branch. You know, that way, nothing bad can happen. Took me a while to realize all the branches were controlled by the same interests in this country. You see, checks and balances, please. You know. So all you have to do, this is democracy. There's a constitution, there's checks and balances, and all you have to do as a citizen is to go to the polls and vote every 4 years for one or another. Not for the other, not for, you know, it's a limited multiple choice test. You know, A, you have A and you have B, or A and A prime, or what you have. But, you know, that's your job as a citizen, to vote, you know. And once you've done that, once every 4 years, that's it. They do what they want, you know. There were people during the Vietnam War who said to the protesters, hey, Lyndon Johnson was elected our president, and once we elected him president, we have to keep silent. That's a strange notion of democracy. But what became clear to me, living through and participating in the civil rights movement, the Constitution, the checks and balances, the formal structure of government, the checks and balances, what have they done for black people in this country? There's no clear example of the inadequacy of any structure to give democracy. I mean, because after the 14th and 15th Amendments, black people had the Constitution on their side. With the 14th Amendment, there shouldn't have been racial segregation. With the 15th Amendment, no blacks should be prohibited from voting. But every president of the United States, from near the end of the Civil War to the 1960s, failed to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments. You might say every president of the United States violated his oath of office, because you take the oath as president to see to it that the laws are faithfully executed, and no president did that. So the racism in the South and all the terrible things that happened in the South were not simply Southern racist phenomenon. It was the federal government, including liberals and, you know, Kennedy and Johnson. It didn't matter who was in office. They collaborated with the South. And it was only when black people rose up, only when they began to sit in and boycott and demonstrate and protest, and by the hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands arrested and so many beaten and so many killed, only when they did this and they all over the South and created a commotion in the country which was heard around the world, only then did the three branches of government begin to respond, and they passed the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Civil Voting Rights Act and so on. And I suddenly realized, oh, yes, this is it. Democracy has come alive. You know, this is when democracy comes alive, you know, when people act for themselves. They don't trust in the democratic structure of government, which has no democracy in it until people organize, you know, and do things, you know. And the labor, you know.
This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. You're listening to a talk by historian Howard Zinn.